I'm happy to have somebody else be the facilitator, but I'll do it if...
By default.
If that's what people would like. Okay. So we'll start with a discussion topic, date and time. It is the group discussions. It is the sharing our stories. It is 11:40. What's the date? October 2nd. 2015. So everybody goes around and in 15 seconds, name, where and when you worked in the South. Just like we just did, but just really quickly. So would you like to start?
Sure. Leverett Millen, and I worked in Fairfield County, South Carolina, in the summer of 65.
Jim Herman, Allendale, South Carolina, 1965.
Steve Press, Orangeburg, South Carolina, 1965.
John Pappin, Calhoun County, South Carolina, 1965.
Lynn Goldberg, Calhoun County, South Carolina, 1965.
Janine Palms, Allendale, South Carolina, 1965. Anybody else do any in 1966?
I did. Chicago, 1966.
And I worked in, I was in the Meredith March in 1966, and also some counties in Georgia in 1966.
And Leverett Millen, I was in Manning, in Clarendon County in the winter of 1966 and the summer of 1966. It's one of the four counties that was involved in the 54th suit to desegregate schools.
Oh, okay.
And it was still segregated in 1966.
And did you go on the Meredith March as well?
No.
A reminder, because I forgot, when we speak, we say our name, Jim Herman.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, every time we start to talk, we say our name.
Yeah.
And the three rules, I don't know if everybody had a chance to read this, but I'll just say them. So the first one was what Jim just said. Second one was everyone has a right to be heard, no one dominates. Everyone speaks before anyone speaks again. Each person gets a turn before anybody else speaks again. Stay on the topic without digressions into other areas. After everyone has a chance to speak, then a group discussion with responses limited to 2 minutes, but I think we're just telling about our experiences, so this may not apply exactly. That will be it, and then we have to get that back to Bruce. Anyone like to start out with telling of your stories? A story?
Not a very vocal group.
Well, I have one that would maybe start this off that was a very interest to me, Janine. The day before yesterday, when we met with one of the people that, Jim, you know, Robbie Dix, who is the son of the family that invited us to come into Allendale. We were speaking with him, and apparently their decision for people to come there was made fairly late. His dad called King, whom he had gone to school with at Morehouse, and said, we would like a group to come, and that's how we got to go to Allendale. When we got there, I didn't realize this, but when it was announced that we were coming, and Robbie Dix Sr., well, Robbie Dix, the dad, asked people in the neighborhood, people in the area, who would like to host us. Lots of people said yes, but then a couple days before we were to arrive, there was some feelings of fear, and everybody virtually declined, and we were left without a place to be. There were about 6 to 8 of us in our group, I believe. There were two people who are not here because, two people that were from a different university. Jim and I were from Wayne State University. We were a Scope chapter there, and there were four other people, Jim, I think at least, Patty, Louise, Phyllis, my brother John, anybody else you can pick up? I think that was it.
I think that was it.
So that was six of us.
You know, plus the two guys from New York.
Oh, yes, Bill and, yes, Bill and Lance. Bill Loya and Lance Nelson. So that was eight of us. So we were left with eight of us without a place to stay. Apparently, Robbie Dix, the minister, asked his son to go to the person house behind and say that he had some friends coming in town and could he offer them some place to stay. And she, of course, said yes. And so I and one other person whom I can't remember who it was went over with our bags when we arrived and came to the doorstep, and she looked at us in utter surprise. It was not something that was done ever for any white people to stay with African-American families. But she welcomed us in, and we stayed there. And after a couple days, when everybody was camped out at the Dix's house, and the houses hadn't been burned down, then lots of people in the community came forward and said, oh, we want one, we want one, we want one. And then we were able to find other housing. So that was the story of how we got ourselves housed there.
Lynn Goldberg, Goldsmith Goldberg. I was part of a group from Brandeis, which John Babin was also part of, and we originally were assigned to Columbia, South Carolina, and we went there and we met some people and did some canvassing, learned the ropes there. But we decided that we wanted to go to a more rural situation. So there were several counties available, and I think Calhoun County and Kershaw County were both available, and I apparently picked one out of a hat and ended up in St. Matthews. And when we arrived in St. Matthews, we were temporarily housed with Reverend Howell, who was an elderly man. And I'm not sure that he was there at the time. I can't remember from my, I have a diary. But he let us use his house, and some of the other participants were housed at other places, and then we were moved several times. We couldn't really find a place, but we eventually got a house all to ourselves, which would serve as our office and our sleeping arrangement. So that was really a good situation. And I know that we visited in Orangeburg many times.
We had a respite together.
Yeah. We worked back and forth, and we got arrested together. So that was kind of our introduction to South Carolina.
My name is John Babin, and I served in Calhoun County. Calhoun County was a culture shock for me because I had grown up in the city that was the most crowded city in North America, and here I am in a county with 12,500 total population, if that. And, to add on to what Lynn's already said, it was an intimidating place. Right away, we had trouble with the local law enforcement authorities. We even got chased at night by the head of the Kentucky KKK with the lights off coming back from Orangeburg. I remember I was in the back automobile and knew there were some military people in the front automobile, people who were on leave. So I flashed the SOS on the flashlights, and when the automobiles pulled together, unbeknownst to me, our two high school students pulled guns out from under their shirts, and that drove off that KKK person. Mm-hmm. We also had a situation where things were getting very dangerous. I mean, and we were really afraid people would get hurt. People were being threatened all over the place. I was looking at my FBI files and saw one of them recounted on my first day in there in a confrontation. But more than that, the KKK had a meeting at the Winn-Dixie supermarket parking lot, and there was probably 500 to 1,000 local people at the meeting. And I was on the telephone doing security, and I think Lynn and her father came by just after the South Carolina State football team, which was at that time sending players more than any other team, except for, I think, Grambling and Notre Dame, to the American Football League and the National Football League, showed up at the front door onto the hill, telling me they wanted to go to a Klan meeting. I told them I couldn't leave my post until I got an all clear. I got an all clear, went with Lynn and her father to the Klan meeting, stood at the back of the Klan meeting, knowing full well the South Carolina State football team was going to, fully armed, gonna go up on the stage, which they did basically. They told the Klan people, "We know who you are, you're not gonna be here tomorrow, because if you do, we're gonna come get you." Sure. End of the KKK in that county. And we, after that, we were fairly safe. Just to give you a little taste of what that was like. And this guy shared a cell from Orangeburg. I didn't recognize until we just happened to be chumming around, and then I realized, I said, "Gee, we were all arrested."
Right. Yeah, although the women were separated from the men. We had plusher. No, we didn't have plusher.
Yeah, it was pretty unplush in
there. Yes.
I'm Steve Prassen. As was just explained, I was in Orangeburg, South Carolina. It was a group that was from Columbia University, which also had a joint program with Jewish Theological Seminary. So the head of our group was a Columbia JTS student, and there were several others. But most of the group was just regular Columbia. I was probably the youngest in the group, and was 18, just turned 18 at the time. That we stayed in two houses that were owned by the local Catholic Church, and we were told the only rule that was that the boys and the girls had to stay in the separate houses, but I think we violated that pretty quickly, because we did. We were threatened. There were anonymous phone calls. Somebody, you know, and I'm thinking, I thought it was an anonymous phone call, but I think I may have been the driver, but one of us made an illegal left turn, or a student left turn, and we were stopped, and nothing, no ticket, no nothing, but the police officer said, you know, some parts of South Carolina are just as bad as Mississippi, so we got that kind of warning. And for about, I think it was 2 weeks in the middle of the summer, we all left Orangeburg and went out to various rural parts of the county where we stayed with families. And I went to Branchville, which was this little rural small town. And we stayed with the family, and there was one point we were, some teenagers probably were just kind of driving back and forth in front of the house trying to intimidate us. But nothing happened with that. The scariest thing was, I guess we were doing voter registration, door-to-door canvassing in Branchville, and we were driving along a street and the car broke down. And I think really bad, I think the axle broke, and the front axle broke. And so we had to get out of the car, and we were being kind of, at that point, we were being trailed. So we ran into this field where we noticed There was a coral snake. So we were caught between two different kinds of snakes. I don't remember how we got out, but we did. Somebody called the police, and they were going to give us a ticket for parking the car in the middle of the street. We explained what the situation was. I think they still gave us a ticket. But the police officer was not wearing his hat, and apparently there is a law in South Carolina that when police officers give tickets, or they have to be in full uniform, and he was not, so that got thrown out on a stupid technicality, but so nothing happened with that. But we made friends with the local college kids. It's, Orangeburg was kind of, I don't know if you call it a college town, but it did have a South Carolina State College where there was a Kent State situation that, of course, got much less publicity because it was a black school, not a general school. And the other one was Claflin, which was a Methodist school. So it was a bit more urban than other parts. There was even a synagogue there, and the JTS students, who were future rabbis, were joking, it's probably closed for the holidays. But it was closed for the summer, so we never connected with the rabbi, and which we were hoping to do. So 30 seconds. So that was, I mean, there's a lot more to it. I mean, my memories of it, a lot of the memories are happy, fun memories. I got to be really close friends with some of the local guys down there, and I had a girlfriend that summer, a local girl from there. And I'm probably going over. I kept wondering, why isn't there anybody else from that group here? And then I realized maybe we fell apart. We did not maintain a scope or a chapter after we got back. And it was the war in Vietnam, and that's what most of us got involved with. So if this was an old Columbia SDS or independent committee, we've had Columbia strike reunions, and those are very well attended. Well, I haven't had one lately, but we didn't continue as with the scope identity after this. So, okay, I'm done.
excuse me, I'm Jim Herman. I was in Allendale, South Carolina. What a summer, full of really a lot of stuff, even though when we came down, we were supposed to have the Voting Rights Act in early summer. That didn't happen, so we were only allowed to register people one day a month. In spite of that, I had spent a week in Alabama before showing up where my assignment was. And in Alabama, we were intimidated. We could hardly go anywhere. The police cars followed us everywhere. So when I got to South Carolina, basically we were a group of idealistic young people from the north, and Robbie Dix, the Reverend Robbie Dix, who invited us, had his parish was, his church was right across the street from his house, and there was about two or three other Protestant churches along the same area. That was all in the black community. Allendale, South Carolina, probably had around 4,000 population. Mostly the county itself was a majority black county. That was the way that SCLC kind of picked out these counties. But there were very few people registered. Actually, from an age group standpoint, there was hardly anybody, black people, anybody between the ages of 18 and 45 in the town. They all went to Brooklyn or Cleveland or Detroit. But the thing that was really interesting, I think, what happened, and we got kind of busy right off the bat, was the connection that Robbie Dix had with the other ministers that were pretty much in the even more rural areas, was an entree, an introduction for us to go to those churches, participate, and of course give our message about registering to vote. I'm trying to say this kind of quick. So in July, we had about 200 people show up to register, and about 30 of them got registered. And that was a record, broke all the records for the day, but there was 170 people that didn't. And we were, of course, quite concerned about that. SCLC's instructions was, you know, don't cause any problems. We didn't try any. But then the next month, which was August, we had also one day. And so we had our sponsors, a guy named Henderson was a Baptist minister from Detroit, and Joe Walsh was a Catholic minister who was the chaplain for the Newman Center, and the five people from Wayne State were all connected with the Newman Center. So I said, they wanted to come down and visit us anyway, so I told them to come down on the day we're going to have some work to do. Mm-hmm. And so they were present. I had also called SCLC and told them that we were going to have 200-300 people again. In the morning, they said, if those people show up, give us a call. So I did that. They sent out four pros from Atlanta to come down. Well, they came down. We pretty much ran the day, but when 5 o'clock came, the police and that said, registration is over, go home. And Leon Hall from SCLC said, we're not going anywhere. So that caused a confrontation. The police immediately came in, arrested me and Lance Nelson, who was 6'5". They thought we were the leaders. We didn't have any particular leader, but I was doing most of the talking during the day, crowd control and stuff, and Lance because of his size. So all of this happened pretty instantaneously. And I say that because then they came back. I was, of course, away by the way, we had a number of publicity. We had some people from the New York Times. As it turned out, my picture wound up being in the arrest. A policeman bopped me in the face when I was getting into the car. But anyway, I don't have enough time to go into all these details. The important part was that they came back and told the rest of the people, anybody that stays here, you're going to get arrested. Jeannie and three of the other women, young women that were with us, immediately, they got arrested. That sort of forced these guys who came down just to visit to make a moral decision. And they wound up getting arrested. big news for SCLC when a white Baptist minister got arrested. Also, after we got arrested, I'll be real quick, this was in the New York Times. We got bailed out. It'd take longer to tell that part of the story, but we got bailed out by a guy working for the Justice Department, and the New York Times had a column in that, U.S. government bails out civil rights workers. Again, SCLC couldn't ask for something better because Dr. King, just a few days earlier, had said he's going to start filling up the jails because he didn't pass the damn Voting Rights Act. Long story short, it got quite a bit different than in Allendale, you know, with the pros in charge and also with what was going on. I will mention in Allendale, for what it was worth, maybe that's why it was calm before this, was that the Governor McNair, that was his hometown, and Mendel Rivers, the head of the Armed Services Committee, that was his hometown. So that could have had something to do with the fact that we weren't intimidated, before that. That's it. There's a lot more to the story, and I got a few pictures. But
well, I'm this Leverett Millen. I worked in Fairfield County, in South Carolina, right next to Columbia, and it was a life-changing experience. And when we got to the three people from Penn State went to do the organizing, and when we got there, we were invited by the local black leader who was a funeral director, and he was very excited about having us come, and we got huge publicity, and there was a lot of excitement. In fact, the first time we had a mass meeting, we had 180 people show up, and then the black leadership got intimidated and said that we needed to leave, and we called SCLC, and they said, we talked about it, and we said, well, let's hold a mass meeting and see if people will come and support us. And over 300 people came, and it was just an amazing experience to have that support of the of our work. And we were, of course, the state senator from Fairfield County wrote letters to the Columbia Record newspaper about the outside agitators. And one of the things we did, that we started a great books seminar for the teenagers in the county, and that was very moving. And what I learned, one of the things I learned is the amazing ability of the black parents to teach their children that, on the one hand, we're living in a society that is incredibly hostile and racist, and then as well teach them about resilience and spirit and how to fight back. It was amazing to make the connections with the teenagers, and how they appreciated their mothers who taught them how to weave their way through this system and maintain a spirit of connection. And I kept up letters with some of the teenagers for several years afterwards. So that's one of the stories from the experience.
Well, I'd like to add a couple of more things that Jim said. There was a chart that had listing of all the counties that we were working in, and what the percentage of African Americans and the percentage of whites that were registered to vote in those counties. And that was one of the first shocks to me, was how in the world could there be 115% of the whites registered to vote and 17% of the blacks? And come to find out, well, they just voted for a lot of the people that had died, and they were still on the roll. Because I believe, as you said, perhaps Jim, oh, I forgot, Janine, that I think there might have been a majority of
most of the counties had a majority of population of blacks.
Yes.
They had
yes.
very few registered voters.
Yes, yes. So that was one of the first reality situations that came up against. And then just the fear of being together, of any, and one of the things that they told us in orientation was, we're not pushing integration in certain areas. We are focusing on education, organizing, and voter registration. So please don't push any other things. We're not trying to integrate lunch counters. We're not trying to, you know, push that issue at all. But it was very difficult, because when we had a mixed group of us working together, how do we travel around together if we couldn't ride together? So we ended up doing things of whoever was in the minority had to get down the bottom of the, you know, in the wells of the car and hide, and we'd put blankets over, and we would drive around that way, which was a very bizarre kind of thing for me. But the hospitality of people, on the one hand, and the fear of, because as we were talking to Robbie a couple days ago, he said, blacks just didn't associate at all with whites in terms of anything social. You didn't go in each other's houses, you didn't do any of those things. And I have some photos of even the offices of doctors and other businesses, white colored, or it was around in the back. And that's, and the reality of that for me was startling. And then when there were threats, when any kind of activity would go on down on Flat Street, there were some bars lower in there, and there was a shooting one night, and there was the talk of, well, why didn't he go up and shoot all those upstarts from the north and get rid of them, these troublemakers in the county, trying to create unrest and trying to make people think that they didn't have a good life. So that was another thing I had to add.
This is Steve. Let me just, it's interesting that you had different instructions than we, was it SCLC itself that said don't don't do the integration work, or was it your local?
No, it was SCLC when we were having orientation for that week.
Okay.
That was what we said. Well, that was what we were told.
We must have.
That's what I remember anyway.
We must have been in the alternative, in a different parallel universe orientation. I don't remember what was said at orientation, but not.
I think that was said.
Okay, we did do that. We did integrate lunch counters.
Yeah, we did too.
And one in that small town in Branchville, there's a funny story about that, but it's not all that relevant for this, but we did that. We also picked out deliberately restaurants on the U.S. highways, because that was governed by federal law. Branchville itself, you know, local places, but if it's on like a U.S. 24 highway, it's governed by federal law because it's a U.S. highway. So we deliberately also did that. It was probably the most enjoyable part of the work we did, because the food was really good. And I was interviewed by the FBI, not just me, but a bunch of us who went, not for the Branchville restaurant, but for the one on, and you know, sat in the car, and they were very professional, and I don't know whatever happened with that. But they did half, Justice Department, I guess, ordered, was Bobby Kennedy, just ordered them to do the, to at least investigate. So, we heard it differently, or just like
ignored it,
or just like we ignored the Catholic Church and who got to stay where, we ignored SLIC and we took it on ourselves to integrate.
Wow, a lot of memory bubbles. Actually, I don't know. You might have been present, but we did go to one restaurant, Jim Herman.
Jim, say who you are.
Jim Herman. We did go to one restaurant, and they made the blacks go around to the back, and we wound up filing a complaint.
Right.
But it wasn't. We didn't actually try to confront, as far as it goes. But I'll again try to say very closely, because one of the things that I profoundly remember, and then I'll say something about. Didn't you go with us to the Catholic Church? And I'll save that a little bit. But basically, like I said, Robbie. Dix, because there was a community of Christian reverence in that, and almost everybody down there went to one church or another.
Yeah.
And when they got the okay, you know, from their minister, and we would speak it, you know, and you put in our 5 cents worth of town people to show up to vote in that. Generally, when we knocked on doors, we had an experience with the plantation guy with a shotgun, but. But generally, when we walked on it, the people were not fearful of us anymore because they knew who we were. And when you would go into their house, I mean, that was part of that whole transformation of being accepted in very strange life. I grew up in an all-white suburb, as far as that goes, even though I'd been in the military and had some peer-black relationships. Nothing like what was happening in 1965 in the South, where colored signs were still up. And the whole works. It had to be a cultural shock. This was the United States. This wasn't Russia or something. Anyway, I'll try to cut this off, but I'm sure we all experienced this. If we went into those black homes, how welcomed you were. And I remember almost every home you'd go into had a picture of Dr. King and a picture of Kennedy.
Right.
You know, and so there was that certainly buoyed you up for far more. And of course, when our demonstration took place and all that, it was really being run by SCLC at that time, and that was just a fabulous thing. In my particular case, SCLC thought I was in danger, so they sent me to Atlanta. So I had to leave some of that. But you know, like the guy was talking earlier, I wasn't aware of being in anybody's gun sights, but the whole place had to be that way. I mean, it didn't cost for so much bravery for us because it was our own community. And I will say one thing, because otherwise I might forget it. We were, the ones from the Newman Center anyway, were Catholics. And there was a Catholic church right close by where we were at. And it was all white. I think there were two or three blacks maybe in the church. We would go to church there on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And after the first 6 weeks or so like that, I decided to go talk to the to the white priest there. I mean, he certainly knew who we were, you know, coming because we were strangers in that. And I told him, I said, I can read, you know, from your, you know, the lectern and that. And he made it very clear to me that he didn't want to have anything to do with us. After that, we didn't go to church there anymore. It was just didn't feel spiritually right for me anymore. Mm-hmm. But we did have that. But that was non-confrontational. I went there as a Catholic, not as a civil rights worker, but we were outsiders, of course.
Leverett Millen, this is on the question of culture shock. One of the most startling things that I learned that summer was when a white woman, after we'd had the big demonstrations on registration day, why don't you go home and clean up your own backyard? And I'm from Boston, and so I did. I went back to Boston because I was. It was the end of summer, and I was waiting to go to school. And there was a movement by black parents to take their children to outlying areas of Boston schools that had 15 or 18 students in a class versus the ones that the black children went to where there were 40 children in class with crumbling walls. And so they hired buses to go to the black parents hired buses to go to these outlying schools, which was part of the, which was legal. And I rode along on one of the buses as a monitor. And the principal, when we got to the school, the principal stood in the doorway and blocked the children from coming in. So much for the difference between the North and the South.
It's on my terms.
Yeah, I mean, with me, as far as culture shock goes, I was living in a city of well over 100,000 people.
John, right?
Yes, John Babin. And it was only 4 square miles, the whole place. And there were only about 200 blacks in the whole city. They were more middle class than the whites. The only black I was ever close to was actually Malcolm X, who befriended me when I was selling scorecards and newspapers outside Fenway Park when I was about 14. And he was my buddy. You know, he liked me. He liked me because I did not knowing who he was at first. He came up to me and said, "Oh, you always fascinate me because you always have books with you." And he asked me what books he should read, and I named off, you know, the Bible and Karl Marx and Confucius and the Koran. And when I said the Koran, he almost went nuts and started. After that, I could do no wrong with him. So it was a culture shock for me when I went to South Carolina. But we could not have functioned if we try to keep all white or all black. I mean, we couldn't have communicated with anybody unless we were in an integrated group. I mean, we had high school volunteers and the local people. There was no way we could have had any ability to relate to the people there if we had actually paid attention to what SCLC said about, you know, keeping the races separate. Yeah, well, that wasn't our priority. Wasn't integration, but we fell into it anyway. I mean, there was one day when a bunch of local kids come walk into the house, you know, young little, you know, elementary school, and said, "Well, we're going to go down to the swimming pool because we're not allowed to swim there." And, you know, we're there. We didn't tell them to do anything. They came to us and said what they were going to do, which we considered to be a success.
They had been taking the initiative.
And we just kind of sat back and watched them do it. And, you know, of course, the pool got closed for good.
Yeah, it's still closed.
It was fine with them because they couldn't go in it anyway.
Never opened.
I mean, but, you know, so, you know, we had dangerous situations, right? It was a very dangerous situation. It was a rural county. And those were the more dangerous counties. But, you know, we survived. I mean, luckily. I mean, there were times when we almost didn't. I mean, the house was kind of shot up, and I had to face down more than once of people with guns in my face and type of stuff like that. You know, that was, I just took it as, you know, this is the way it is.
Lynn Goldberg. I have in my diary some fairly detailed comments about trying to integrate a restaurant and how we sort of got around some of their ways of shutting you out. You know, they would close the restaurant and lock the doors, and then they would only let their friends in, you know, that sort of thing. But it was very common to, when we did try to eat lunch, they would either ignore us completely and, you know, or they would, occasionally we would try to sort of separate ourselves, the white people and the black people, and if they knew we were together, they wouldn't serve the white people either.
Hmm. Steve, just along with that, we had an experience in a couple of places that we desegregated where the owner said, well, we'll serve the coloreds, but not the whites.
Because they have to.
Thinking that was the law. Huh? They had to serve black people, as opposed to they couldn't discriminate on the basis. So,
right.
So that was another basis for the federal complaint that we filed.
Yeah.
Us whites were discriminated against. I don't remember how those resolved, if they didn't serve us. Well, I don't know. But that was certainly something we complained about.
Anybody else have any other comments?
I could take up the next 2 hours, but I'm not going to do that. But the so many different kind of things. For instance, like I said, we had little contact really with the white community, even though it was visible, because it wasn't that big of a place. But you know, different things also would emerge. The black superintendent of schools, basically for the black schools, and that was friendly with the white establishment, and that white establishment wanted him to be the spokesman. Well, the ministers and that were not crazy about this guy, but they had to deal with that reality. And so some of that emerged. We didn't get much involved with that, but it was obvious. And so some of the intimidation and stuff that citizens there had to deal with, you know, also were on different other kind of levels, you know, within their own community. And you could not be partly aware of that. It didn't have too much to do with our business. On our business, what I'll say is, like, you guys and that had set up these freedom schools, and these were adults that were coming to the freedom schools, not teenagers, because they didn't know how to read. And Jeannie and some of the other, they were quite successful. Maybe you might want to even say about that. I mean, by successful, I mean these were like three or four times a week all summer long. And so, you know, and you don't learn how to read in one day or anything anyway. And so they, and I'm not correct on this. I wasn't too involved with that. I was more involved with knocking on doors in a different kind of time. But did you do this, some of that?
Jeanine, I remember mostly knocking on doors.
Oh,
I don't remember doing a lot of
stuff. Pad,
so maybe
yeah.
It was some of the other people that were doing that. I do remember that there were a number of local young people from the area who joined with us, and we have some photos of them being on the porch, and we're all singing together. Lance was played the guitar, and we would sing a lot, and they joined us for that. And then one of the really impressive things was that just recently, in the beginning of this summer, that actually the South Carolina legislature made a proclamation honoring five of the people who lived in Allendale, and three of them are still alive. One of them I hope to see on Sunday, Marion Jennings, who is now the director of the county Democratic Party. And she kept working after we left, but they were very much involved with us and did a lot of work with us. And that's a question that I have that stayed with me for after I left, and also sort of continuing on, was that we as whites, being privileged citizens, come to a place where it's almost the opposite end of the spectrum, where people aren't even franchised, they can't even vote, and we come in, and this is sort of putting it in short language, but we come in and basically raise cane, we raise all these things, and people come out and join us who live there, they have to stay and take whatever repercussions come from sort of changing the whole culture that had been there, not saying that that was, not judging that that was a good culture, it was not. But nonetheless, this was poking holes into it, and then we could leave. And what kind of impact does that have on the community, and did they foresee those kinds of things happening as well? And so sort of that's one of the questions and one of the things that I grappled with a lot after I left, and in fact wrote my my senior essay on white involvement with issues like that, and what is the role of whites in a situation like that. So I don't know if anybody else has thought about that or had feelings about it or has been in contact with people from your from the county that you worked in to see where people are at, but I just open that up, throw that out as a...
Steve, in Orangeburg, we were basically asked to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a kind of, there had been a very active NAA chapter there, and in fact, a lot of the college kids, who also were local Orangeburg people, were very proud of their arrest record in high school, because there was a lot of activity going on, and then it kind of stopped. For whatever reason, the NAA chapter just kind of not functioning, it still existed. And so one of our jobs explicitly was to be the worker bees in getting that going again. Mm-hmm. What are you guys, you're the people, what would you like us to do to help NAACP rise again in Orangeburg? I don't remember specifically what we did, but that was our job, so that after we did leave, that would be going strong. So, I really lost touch with Orangeburg afterwards, which is sad, so I don't know what happened. I know about the massacre, but that's about it. And I want to bring up, if I may, changing the subject a little bit, to other things. First is the humorous one. As I said, there were some members of, you know, of our group were from Jewish Theological Seminary. They were, I guess, future rabbis or going into Judaic studies, whatever. So we were integrating a restaurant in Ranchville, and we were sitting there. That place served us. No problem there. And there were all these, like, white high school girls standing by the cashier, talking with the cashier who worked there. They were all friends, you know. And this is a culture shock piece, and kind of fitting the stereotype we had as Northerners. Y'all this and y'all that, and you going in, you know, with the white Southern accent and all that. And one of them turns around to leave, and she's wearing a Jewish star. We went, we did not expect that, but probably the local dry goods store was owned by a Jewish family, which was typical.
Yes.
Second thing that kind of my first introduction, I didn't know any gay people that I knew were gay. I'm sure I did, but I didn't back then. Nobody was out about it. The organist at the Catholic Church may also have been the choir director. He was black. I'm not sure if the church itself was into it. I don't know what. But he was black. He was gay. And he let us know because he kind of felt safe with us. And he admitted that he was worried, that he couldn't get out because he was worried about his job.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, mom's worried. We didn't say anything. But he was cool. But, you know, it wasn't, for, you know, oh, okay, so that's the deal. Then, one day, a kid shows up, our age, college age, white kid from Aiken, South Carolina, and I don't know where that's from. He wanted to join our group because he couldn't do anything in Aiken because he was gay.
Mm.
And we said, oh, sure, no problem. And so he joined our group. And I just forgot about that till this weekend. But, and so that was, you know, and it was all positive and all in a set. in a sense, for me personally, I think the rest of it is, that was a non-issue. Gay, wahoo, big deal, you know. So it's very interesting.
We had, in St. Matthew, this is Lynn, in St. Matthew's we had a lot of local people that worked with us, and I guess it was hard to see what progress we were making because it really was very minimal at the time. But things were happening. I know one of the students came north to stay with my parents for a year to go to high school, and I remember he had completed high school supposedly in St. Matthew's, and I was sort of coaching him before he started at Princeton High School, and he literally did not know that you start a sentence with a capital letter. He didn't know to indent for a paragraph. I mean, basic stuff. And I was wondering how he was going to make out. Well, he did fairly well. He was a bright guy, and he eventually went back to South Carolina, and he worked for the Department of the Army and had a fairly good life. And I do still keep in touch with one of the sons of our host, who was Furman Hart, was our host sort of supervisor, looking after us kind of thing. And Melvin Hart, who I still talk to, was a little bit younger than most of the other kids, but he remembered that summer when we were down there and the KKK having their little get-together and all that sort of thing. So, and I spoke to Melvin last week, and he said that things have changed. It is somewhat better, and I'm looking forward to, he wants to have our group come and visit St. Matthew's again, and they want to host a party for us because they're very thankful for what we did. And so hopefully we're going to arrange that at some time. And since I will be moving to South Carolina, that will make it easier for me anyway.
This is Leverett Millen, and there were three, and this is about the aftermath of our experience. There were three teenagers that were very involved with our community education group, and they all, and I kept up letters with them for several years later, and all three of them went north to college, and all said they wanted to go back and work in the public schools and build better things for their community. So that we really were able to energize their connection with their community in a way that was affirming.
Jim, would like to say something.
One of the other things might be interesting if we do want to talk about it is, well, what happened to our lives afterwards?
Oh, yeah.
For me, I was inspired by what happened in Allendale to when Dr. King brought the program north. That was even more exciting to me because I considered myself a city person, and so was a volunteer in Chicago. That was quite it'd take too long to go into it, those experiences. But what it resulted in, I was still in college, and at the college I was in, as an undergraduate, set up their senior year for you to write a paper, or do a work of art, or by a paper. They usually meant like a 60-page thing. It was kind of a little bit like a master's thesis, as long as you had a sponsor. So anyway, I wound up by then having 2 years, having done this kind of stuff. Jeannie's father, among other people, provided me with some tapes that were recorded between Selma and Montgomery March, which were full of the C.T. Vivian and Bevel and all these kind of speeches and the music, and that I used that as a prop and gave speeches in the white community in Detroit on open housing. With that being the background, basically it was a biographical kind of thing. And that wound up, so in a sense I got a degree in civil rights when they weren't given degrees in civil rights, because it was most of my senior credit. And then from there I went on to work with the city of Detroit, and then eventually with the federal government in the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, 30 years basically doing affirmative action programs and enforcement. So it was a career changing and answered the questions, where am I going with my life?
Lynn Goldberg. For me, I wrote a fairly detailed diary of every single day that we were there. And I also had a lot of pictures and a lot of things that I had saved, those famous fans that you fanned yourself with in the churches as you sat there and sweat. And my father, who was a devout campaigner for civil rights, he and I were going to publish something with it. And of course the years went by and life went by and my dad passed on. And I said to myself, what am I going to do with all this stuff which is so valuable to people? And I ended up giving it to Brandeis University. And they had some of their graduate students transcribe my hen scratching. And they made a website for me. And this is how I met Miyuki, because she came to Brandeis. And she is studying American history and specializing in the civil rights movement and the connection primarily with Jewish students, because there were quite a few of them. And so it made a connection for us, and we've gotten together several times now. And her students have corresponded, and it's just really neat. So it's been a nice experience.
Leverett Millen, the experience in Fairfield County was life changing and affirming for me, and it had a lot to do with my Jewish identity and trying to question, because my mother had 23 cousins and aunts and uncles who were killed in the Holocaust, and I wanted to try to understand why nobody helped the Jews, and I wasn't going to be silent like that. In fact, how I got involved with SCOPE is Martin Luther King came, he was supposed to speak at Penn State in December, but he got the Nobel Peace Prize, so he came in January, and it was very powerful. And then a couple of months later, I found out he spoke to the rabbi and the ministers about getting a group to go down south, and I went to see the rabbi about kosher food for Passover, and he said, you want to go down south, and that's how I found out. So I have I continued my activism and I went back to Clarendon County, South Carolina, the next winter, fall break and summer, and then was active with SDS. And in fact, there's a book in which I'm featured. Is about campus wars, and it was about the. It was written to counter the stereotype that everybody in SDS was from an elite school. So it was a study of five SDS movements at state universities. Mm-hmm. And I'm in there as being unusual because I'm I was a devout Jewish person who was identified with SDS, and so that has continued through all of the years, and right now I am proud to say that I'm a psychologist with the public schools in Albuquerque, and I have organized a peace club at an inner city high school, and the only one in the city of Albuquerque, and we were just, our work was featured on public radio, it's called Peace Talks Radio, and last August, the end of August, they featured our work. So I'm still going, and it was all from what, you know, the astounding experience of SCOPE.
I'm not going to say my involvement in SCOPE was life-changing, because that was the path I was already on. Mm-hmm. When I was in probably junior high school was when the whole, you know, Woolworth lunch counter mm-hmm. thing was going on, and we had, I grew up on Long Island, which, you know, the Woolworths there were not segregated, but there was a national boycott of Woolworth, and there were pickets there, and I was part of that as, I don't know, 13, 14 years old, no problem, or maybe 14, 15. So this just, in a way, SCOPE was a natural for me to do it. It just kind of continued it. But it sort of pushed me along, and I was glad there was the Jewish context with the group I was in, because that helped me kind of put into words the fact that my political identity, my political involvement, always had a Jewish element to it. There's tikkun olam. I'm not religious. I'm a secular Jew. But tikkun olam, which in Hebrew means repair the world, that's, I've always lived by that. And pretty much any activity I've been in since, I've identified myself as Jewish and talked about tikkun olam as my kind of guiding spirit. There was it didn't last very long, but there was a group that I was part of in Detroit and Grosse Pointe. For those of you who don't know, Grosse Pointe the realtors there had a point system. And not only being black counted, that was fatal. But if you were dark-skinned, if you were Italian, if you were Jewish, depending on how dark your skin was, you had points against you and all that kind of stuff. Well, I got involved with a group a couple years ago called Alter Gather. Alter Road is the dividing line between Detroit and Grosse Pointe Woods. There are five different Grosse Pointe communities. Grosse Pointe Woods is the one nearest Detroit. That's been integrating for a while. But this group, Alter Gather, was an attempt to kind of bridge both the physical and the metaphoric gap that Alter Road represented. And I probably was the only Jewish member, but I made it very clear as part of why I was involved in this, and it's part of that, and there's now an NAACP chapter forming in Grosse Pointe. I mean, it's incredible that all these kinds of changes are taking place. It's still slow, but yeah, so it kind of, I've continued to be involved, not always, kind of sporadically, but the rest of college was more anti-war work than civil rights work, although the strike at Columbia that I was very much a part of, there were some civil rights issues involved, having to do with Columbia's relationship with the community, and it was not a good relationship on Columbia's part, not on Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Janine, I just want to say a couple of things about what both of you said, all of you said, in terms of the experience that I had as well. For me, it wasn't a life-changing experience either, because that was how my family lived. They were very, they were Catholics to the nth degree in terms of not necessarily rule-oriented, but the spirit of the whole thing. And so they took a vow of poverty. when we were little, and they gave away all their money, and they, when all this came, my father went to the Selma March. It was kind of like with your family, but your parents were the model. And so it was a natural to do this. And I don't remember where we came in contact with the Newman Center, but somehow got that link, and then that's how I found out about it. When I was 18 and my brother was 17, and we joined that chapter.
You guys weren't in college yet.
No, we joined that chapter and went with them. So we were pretty young, but it was kind of a rite of passage for me, because I was definitely, you know, a kid still. I was young. But when I came back, I felt like it had changed who I was. I was very shy. I was no longer shy. And I didn't know much about organizing at all, but I felt like I had a very good base now for doing organizing, which is what I have done a lot of in my life now in different ways in where I live, in terms of things that are unjust, that are inequitable. And my father went on to do work in Bloomfield Hills, which is another kind of gross point thing in terms of fair housing and that sort of thing. And even, you know, we got crank calls and all that kind of thing. And then I worked in Detroit as a volunteer for the next two summers doing work with youth, organizing and doing recreation in areas where it wasn't available. And then went on to doing teaching, and have integrated that and community organizing with a lot of different issues. Oh, and when I was still in Detroit, I worked with Cesar Chavez group and did a lot of in the Great Boycotts and farm workers, and had a lot of connection with that. So different kind of organizations as we've gone through. One of the experiences that I vividly remember in Allendale and was the fear that I developed of whites. And so if I would see whites other than the group that I was working with, because I didn't even sort of identify it. But were whites, period. And I remember in the churches, we were in the church constantly, you know, for whatever was going on, we were there, partly because that was a good place to do organizing, and partly because those were the people we worked with, and that's what people did. And the hymn books we had, and then looking down once, just I remember this, so looking down once and looking, and my hand was white, and I jumped, literally jumped.
Oh my God.
Yes, oh, really? Oh, that's okay. It's just me. But it was.
I might add something.
Say your name.
I'm Marky Kleinfelder. And after being down south, with the rotoscope and so forth, I came back up to New York, and I had to fill in some form, and it said race. So I put down human.
Yes.
And it was interesting, Lynn Goldberg, about the danger that we were facing. I mean, my father, who was very embracing of the whole movement, when I first told him about it, it was, oh no, not my child. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my mother said to him, you of all people should understand. Mm-hmm. And so, and then they ended up going down to South Carolina with a carload of books, because they were, my mother and father were both in education. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to do what they could to help out. And they stayed in our house at the time, as John said, when there was a KKK meeting, and my father drove by and witnessed it. And it was shortly after that the picture window of our house was shot out. Mm-hmm.
Where was that?
In St. Matthews.
Oh, it was down in South Carolina.
Yeah.
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 This is Steve. Janine, did you ever work with Grace Lee Boggs?
I did not. I knew people very well who did work with her.
She's still and going she's strong. Well, I don't know. Strong,
well, she's not. She's actually
she's
pretty
in bad shape, yeah.
Not in not good shape. She's a woman who has done a lot of writing, a very strong activist in Detroit. She's now 100. Wow. And a very clear, focused thinking, very well read activist for many, many years, for her whole life. She's actually Chinese American. She was married to Jimmy Boggs, African American. They first started out in the labor movement, doing all kinds of things with that, and then have continued on and actually did Freedom Summers in Detroit.
Right.
Brought that whole movement sort of into Detroit and have pulled in people who live in the suburbs to come into Detroit and to do something there. So it's place-based work, the kind of thing that the whites were saying to us when we were down there, go home and clean up your own backyard first, which was what we heard a lot. And yes, there are lots of things, but also that experience of doing it with SCLC Scope, I think, helped a number of us to then see where we lived differently and to be able to move into that as well.
You mentioned also that the natural progression, if you were impressed with SCLC, as Dr. King moved towards the peace movement and everything.
Yes.
So many, many of us have had that same experience.
Yes, yes, yes. Any other closing comments, anybody?
Steve, again, I talk too much. Sometimes I always talk too much. Anybody remember Viola Liuzzo?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
She went to Wayne State. She didn't graduate because she was from Detroit. Either she or her husband were labor organizers. I think it was her husband. And I don't know his story, but she was active in the civil rights movement in Detroit, went down south, Mississippi, I guess, and got shot and killed. Mm. Wayne State recently gave her a degree.
Wow.
And here's something else. This is more Detroit. Vincent Chin. Does anybody from
Yes.
Detroit? Okay. Vincent Chin was a Chinese-American, also a Wayne State student, who was shot and killed by whom, I don't know if they ever found who did it, because this was when there was a lot of anger at the Japanese for destroying the American auto industry. He was assumed to be Japanese. He was shot and killed. There's a plaque for him. I didn't know this at Wayne State. I just saw it. So Wayne State, I work there, and it's got its problems, but there's some really progressive stuff that Wayne State does, that things like that, that they don't necessarily make a big deal about. But giving Viola Liuzzo her degree and the plaque and the memory memorial for Vincent Chin,
Jim Herman, the neat thing about Wayne State, for starters, is it's a huge school.
Yeah.
I went to Ohio State for a couple of years when I was in the military, and I was surprised when I first went to Wayne that numbers-wise there was 30,000 students at Wayne.
That.
Way different than the ones at Ohio State. You had this urban thing, and an awful lot of them were graduate students, of course, and a lot of them were night students.
Yep.
They did have but the point was that it was in the city.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I am not from New York, but it'd be NYU or something.
Right.
And so you had this real life going on that you don't have going on at some other great schools, at Michigan and whatever. So it was also the opportunity to be a part of, in a sense, the real life. Most of the students there, to some extent, were laborer sons and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite the neat experience if you're a liberal.
Right.
Right.
Well, it's been wonderful hearing everybody's stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.